Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for September 30, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got several segments up tonight. First of all, right about the bottom of the hour, about 5:30, delivering a report on whether there is indeed some partisan bias at the Gallup poll. A little after 5:30, I'll be asking that question and offering some evidence suggesting that maybe there is. Before we get that, we'll be talking in a little while with Seth Kleinman, who is an analyst with the PFC Energy Corp, about the state of the oil market, why oil prices are so high, and their projections of a long-term decline in oil production, which should set in sometime in the next decade or two, and what that means, why they project that, what that means, and what we might do about it. And then about 5:40 or so, rerun an interview ran during a fundraising show a couple of weeks ago, which didn't really get to air fully because we're interrupting and talking over and such. So it's with Glenn Ford, who is one of the editors of the website, The Black Commentator, about the presidential election. Some second half of the show will be very presidential themed, given tonight's opening debate in the set of three so-called debates. So we'll get about 10 minutes or 11 minutes of Glenn Ford talking about presidential politics, and I'll talk some about economic records of the various presidencies and also some polling stuff as well. So that's the second half of the show, and we'll be picking up with Seth Kleinman in about 8 minutes. A couple of announcements first. Fundraiser for the Brecht Forum, a good friend of WBAI and vice versa. They're moving to a spiffy new headquarters, and they need to raise some money to do so. One of the things they're doing is throwing a party by and for the people. That's this coming Saturday, October 2nd, beginning at 8 p.m. and going into the wee hours, or some approximation of that, featuring the Welfare Poets 512, DJ Aiden, DJ Carlito, DJ Chris Maestro, DJ Eric Mons, and DJ Kat Aaron, familiar to WBAI listeners. So that's 122 West 27th Street, 10th floor. Again, this Saturday, benefit for the Brecht Forum at their soon-to-be former headquarters, 122 West 27th Street, 10th floor. Help them finance their move. And also another event this Monday, October 4, 7 to 9 p.m., sponsored by several friends of ours, including the Brecht Forum, also the Nation Institute, the New Press, and the Graduate Center at CUNY, their Continuing Education and Public Programs series, Regime Change Begins at Home, several New Press authors, moderated by Lewis Lapham, the editor of Harper's. And the author is Francis Fox Piven, whose book, The War at Home, will be coming out shortly. John Nichols, his book, Dick, on our real president, Dick Cheney. Esther Kaplan, who is author of an imminently forthcoming book on the Christian right. Congressman Sherrod Brown, and a frequent guest on my show, Nomi Prinz, also author of a forthcoming New Press book. That's this Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. at the CUNY Pershansky Auditorium at the Graduate Center. That's 365 Fifth Avenue at 34th Street. Again, the CUNY Grad Center, Fifth Avenue and 34th Street, that this Monday, October 4, 7 to 9 p.m. And some economic headlines. This week's tally of jobless claims, that is the number of people who lost their jobs last week and headed over to the unemployment office to sign up for benefits, that rose by 18,000, the third consecutive week of increases of over 10,000, of over 15,000 actually. Most of these, the increase probably because of the hurricanes in Florida, this number stubbornly high, in sign that maybe the labor market isn't improving as rapidly as one would like. Further evidence of that is that the Conference Board's Help Wanted Index, account of Help Wanted ads in major newspapers around the country, unchanged in the month of August, and it's been pretty much flat now, popping around these levels for months on end. There are some people who say this is no longer a valid measure because of the rise of web-based job advertising, but the month-to-month numbers should show some sense of direction, even if the long-term trend is against this indicator. Also, the Conference Board dissents from that. They say that they still believe in the reliability of the Help Wanted indicator, but in any case, it's suggesting the labor market is still pretty soft. The weekly ABC News Money Magazine poll of consumer attitudes, also unchanged, at a mediocre -9, which is roughly the long-term average in this poll. It had taken a steep dive in the early part of the summer, improved in the latter part of the summer, and now it's kind of stalled out. So consumers are not all that optimistic at the current moment. They're also not all that pessimistic either. And interesting finding in that poll is that there's a wide discrepancy between the perceptions of Republicans and Democrats. And there's normally a wide discrepancy between perceptions of upper income and lower income people, with upper income people, of course, considerably more optimistic. But that gap is within historical norms. But what's really, really wide and unprecedentedly wide over the last few months is what the gaps between what Republicans and Democrats are thinking, with Republicans, of course, much more economically optimistic than Democrats. And so there are a lot of cross currents in the U.S. economy, a lot of regional differences, and now also a lot of partisan differences. The government also reporting this morning that personal income in the month of August was up 0.4%, some of that boosted by so-called transfer payments, that is, insurance payments. Transfer payments are money for nothing, that is, money not for the sale of a good or service or for labor, but just something given with nothing in return. And in this case, this is a lot of insurance payments to hurricane victims in Florida, boosting the personal income numbers, but also some bounce in the income numbers as well, so people, rather the wage and salary numbers as well. So there is some evidence of rising incomes, although it's hardly boom levels, but it's not contracting either. The government reporting that the second quarter estimates of gross domestic product, the big headline number that's supposed to measure the health or lack of it of the U.S. economy, this is the third of the estimate of the second quarter numbers. They do revise these things regularly. And that was revised upwards from the previous estimate, from 2.8 to 3.3% annual growth rate. Still below the long-term average, not bad, not great. And I've been saying here that some of the leading indicators suggesting the economy is slowing down for the rest of the year. And we're certainly experiencing one of the weakest expansions of the post-World War II period. And this is not the kind of numbers you'd see in a kind of vigorous recovery that we've seen from earlier recessions and early recovery periods, and certainly not strong enough growth really to help the job market pick up. So not dismal numbers, but hardly great either. Looking abroad, economic sentiment in the Eurozone declined a little bit in the month of September. Business confidence falling, consumer confidence also falling, and the European economy is still quite sluggish and not doing a very successful job of recovering. French unemployment rate, 9.9% in August, up a tenth of a point, this also kind of disappointing. It's been bobbing around this 9.8, 9.9 level now for at least a year, so not much sign of a pickup in the job market in France. In India, though, a very, very strong report for growth in the second quarter of the year, almost 7.5%. Not quite Chinese levels, but still more than twice what we're experiencing in the United States. And, of course, Indian growth is not all necessarily all that well distributed, but it's there are some signs of strength in the Indian economy. And we'll have more about the Indian economy, a very interesting thing, in the coming weeks and months. And we have do we have Seth Klayman on the line? Yeah, okay. So let's take this little musical break, and we'll be back to talk to him about the oil market.
I never thought about the universe, it made me feel small. Never thought about the problems of this planet at all. Global warming, radioactive sites, imperialistic wrongs, and animal rights. No! Why think all the bad things when life is so good? Why up with an am when there's always a could? Let the whales worry about the poisons in the sea. Outside of California, it's foreign policy. I don't want changes, I have no reactions. Your dilemmas are my distractions. That's the way to go, Franco, un-American. No way to go, Franco, un-American. No way to go, Franco, un-American. No way to go, Franco, Franco, un-American.
Thank you. And that's the first half of a newish song by the venerable punk band NoFX, Franco Un-American. That's, we might consider that the confession portion of the song, and we'll hear the redemption song portion in about 20 minutes. But now we're joined in the line by Seth Kleiman, who is an analyst with PFC Energy, one of the world's leading energy consulting firms based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to WBAI, Seth Kleiman.
Good evening.
So, first of all, let's talk about what – I want to get to the longer-term issues in a moment, but let's talk about the state of the oil market these days. We saw prices pushing $50 the other day, backed
back
off
a
little bit.
Back over 50 today.
Oh, back over – I didn't wasn't following things today, so yep. It's over 50 today. What do you think is driving this latest push from the the mid-40s up towards the $50 range?
Well, if you think of summer as really the season of gasoline and winter as the season of heating oil, we would expect to be in a bit of a lull between those two. But Hurricane Ivan really sliced through all of that. There's still almost 500,000 barrels a day of production of just the type of crude that the world's really looking for, lost right there, right where it really needs to be. This has drastically tightened the markets, and now you have headlines coming out of Nigeria, even though you don't actually see much by way of lost barrels. We were heading towards 50 in the winter. This just brought things forward by a few months.
And now, yeah, let's talk about Nigeria. There were, disruptions of, 20 or 30,000 barrels out of a very large production.
Yeah, it's
so
really
it's not that much, right? But what's happening in Nigeria exactly?
You have, it's not to dismiss it from a Nigerian citizen's point of view, but from the oil market's perspective, there's been internecine strife in Nigeria going on for years now. Partly as a result of that, the oil production facilities are very well defended. And although you did have some rebel groups declaring full-on war against the government and threatening to disrupt oil production and exports, you haven't seen much, and we don't actually expect to see much by way of actual barrels lost.
And, of course, there are several other trouble spots in the oil world. Venezuela, always a source of anxiety. What's the situation like in Venezuela now?
Well, actually, apparent victory for Chavez in the referendum seems to have kept things calm in Venezuela. They're also doing fine. What you're seeing right now, about a month ago when oil first made its run at 50, you had a large speculative element in the markets looking at these headlines and trying to find reasons to run up prices. That's not really what's going on right here now. Here you do have some very bullish, supportive fundamentals, and then you have this barrage of headlines on top of them. But this is really kind of the icing on the cake if you're a speculator, as really evidenced by, if you may have seen, there were some refiners who actually went and asked the government if they could borrow some oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. This is indicative of they were really short of oil. It was genuinely it's really tight out there, and that's why you're getting this bidding war for the right types of crude, the light sweet, which incidentally is the type that Nigeria produces.
Yeah, light sweet and heavy and sour.
Yeah.
And we don't want heavy and sour, which means high specific gravity and full of sulfur. Right?
That's right. That's right.
We want the stuff that's light specific gravity and not much sulfur.
That's right.
Let's talk about the mix of things in the markets. I mean, some people, of course, are blaming hedge funds and speculators for driving prices way beyond rational levels. Who are the major participants driving prices up? Is it people in the industry, users and producers, or is it the speculative elements?
This light, sweet, heavy, sour distinction is important when you're talking about prices. When people see the headline, the price of crude oil went through 50, went through 40. What they're referring to is these benchmark crudes. I don't want to get bogged down in the technical details, but it's important to at least give a broad outline. They're referring to the price of crude of WTI, which is West Texas Intermediate in New York, or Brent in England. These are both light, sweet types of crude, and these are what the world is very short of right now. There's an awful lot, and most of what OPEC is producing is heavier, sourer crudes. The problem is that the world is very short of refining capacity. There's a very, very strong demand for refined product, but there's very short on refining capacity. When you need, the refiners can produce, they can run rather, these light sweet crudes and produce a lot of gasoline and diesel and all this stuff that people really want to buy. But when they've got this heavy sour stuff, they can't produce very much of it. So the price differentials between the heavy and sours are reaching record levels right now because there's a lot of crude out there. But it's this heavy, sour stuff that people don't really want. There's a genuine shortage of light sweet. And until the world addresses that, addresses the issue of refining capacity, prices are going to stay very high.
Why is refining capacity so tight?
One reason is that environmental regulations have been tightening incrementally over the past few years. Every time people don't like breathing bad air, and so they tighten sulfur regulations. And they're right now we've got the Tier 2 Clean Air Act, Tier 2 part of the Clean Air Act, tightening specifications on gasoline and diesel in the U.S., and Europe is significantly in the process of really, really clamping down on sulfur to almost negligible levels. That's fine from an environmental perspective, but refineries, which have traditionally been a very poor investment, very poor return for oil companies, so they have not received a lot by way of investment, are now, there's really a crunch on, and people are paying the price in expensive gasoline, expensive diesel, and expensive oil.
Now, I've heard the theory that oil companies like to keep refinery capacity tight because, first of all, you just want to spend the money building capacity, but also if there's a tight demand or something goes wrong, prices go up and they make money and they're happy with that. Is there anything to that theory?
I think it's less sinister than that, really. It's just traditionally they've just been a dire industry. It's any industry, any market which involves massive initial capital investment, huge sunk costs, and then very small marginal costs tends to be very cyclical, and that model is exactly what the refining industry falls under. It can cost you $1 billion to set up a decent-sized refinery. You're going to have to you don't know. It's going to take a long period to earn enough money to pay that off, and things can change in that time. So people are reluctant to make these massive investments.
And so when you build a refinery, price could be 50, and when it comes online, it could be 25.
Exactly. I mean, and that's very similar to what's been happening in the oil industry throughout. A lot of oil companies right now, even though prices are high, aren't running out and spending vast sums on exploration because in the past they've done that. They've bought a lot of stuff online. 2 or 3 years after they spend all this money, the stuff comes online, the prices crash, and they get hammered.
And what about two other contributions to things? First of all, on the supply side, Iraq. How's that contributing to the supply constraints?
Well, very surprisingly, despite the really continuous sabotage of the oil infrastructure there, Iraq's been doing very well. They had September's probably going to be the best year since pre-war. They're up to about 2.4 million barrels a day. They're doing very well. It's really on the margins, partly as a result of not having great equipment on the ground. The quality of their crude has got heavier and sourer, but that's really on the margins of what's affecting oil prices. The fact that they're getting the barrels out is one of the few things that's maybe keeping prices down, if you can say that, at $50 a barrel.
And on the demand side, what is the size of the Chinese contribution to the problem?
It was demand that set the stage for all these other things to come into play this year. Demand's just out of control is not an inappropriate term. We estimate that demand in China this year is growing by about 1 million barrels a day throughout the year, about a 20% increase. And that in 1 million barrels a day, given that the U.S. alone uses about 20 million barrels a day, doesn't seem that much. But when you have a system that at the start of the year was already stretched very tightly, and then you add just from this one country an extra 1 million barrels a day of demand, it forces the entire world to rejig this incredibly massive, expensive, complicated system that was geared towards supplying, pulling crude out of X country and supplying it to Y country. Tankers need to be rerouted. Trade routes all over have to rework themselves. And it's partly just this rejigging complications that's keeping prices so high.
In the past, when oil prices have gotten very high, they've created recessions and the urge to conserve. Oil prices now are really only about half as much as they were at the 1980 peak in inflation-adjusted terms. We're at like $90 a barrel in 1980, if you use today's dollars. Is this enough to have these effects of creating recession or enough of a slowdown to reduce demand and also enough of an urge to conserve to change demand behavior?
Well, I think the latter is really more a matter of political will, unfortunately, which I think the world may also be somewhat short of when it comes to addressing energy issues. On the subject of whether these are high enough prices to cause a recession, we don't think so. Right now, the world seems to be able to cope with $50 oil, partly because developed countries are so much less energy, they're so much more energy efficient than they used to be. China's a different issue. China's very energy inefficient, but it's a bit of a difference. It's a very different story there because what they're doing is importing raw materials and then exporting produce goods. They just pass on the higher price of the raw materials really onto the American consumer who's willing to pay it, partly because they have access to cheap consumer credit, which is underwritten by the Chinese government buying U.S. bonds. So it is a complicated circle, but it does seem to be working, and it doesn't show any signs right now of falling off the tracks. What's a bit scary, given the increased energy efficiency in the world's economy right now, is it raises the question of how high do oil prices have to go until they put a brake on oil demand? Do we have to be talking about $80, $100? It's really hard to know right now. And you also have a further complicating factor that some countries which have significant demand growth this year and going forward, presumably, have price controls in place, which means it's the government that takes the hit. You see this in India, in China, a lot of African countries, and some Latin American countries. So there's not going to be any impact on consuming demand because they're not going to see prices going up.
I'm speaking with Seth Kleiman, who is an analyst with PFC Energy based in Washington, D.C. And let's shift the perspective to a longer term now. PFC Energy, recently released a report saying that sometime in the next, 10 or 20 years, we're going to see a peak in oil production and a long-term decline, and this will lead to a real major change in the energy and economic landscape. What's your rationale for this?
Well, first of all, just to clarify, it wasn't exactly that we were just saying that there's going to be a peak in oil production. What we are saying is you can show with a pretty high degree of clarity and certainty that early in the next decade, it looks like non-OPEC crude production is going to peak. And then you can add in unconventional oil from Canada, GTLs, and natural gas liquids into these. And you can push that peak out into the middle of the next decade. But you're still looking at an enormous increase in market share for OPEC. You can also do the similar kind of analysis on OPEC and for any country, and you can show that every country is producing, with very few exceptions, is producing much more oil than they're finding. And this cannot go on forever.
So when will the crunch come for OPEC, do you estimate?
Part of that depends on the crunch coming in terms of are they able to supply demand. Depends on the demand growth scenario, when what we were doing is modeling a high, low, and base case scenario. And we can show that in a low demand growth scenario, things look okay out through 2020. In a high growth scenario, it looks like a gap develops between demand and supply as early as 2013.
Now, there are some people who say that because of foreign oil companies have been mostly excluded from the OPEC countries, they have not had the benefit of really high-tech exploration techniques. Is there anything to that?
There really isn't. There's a myth out there, a very commonly held myth, that OPEC is massively underexplored. There have been enormous hundreds and hundreds of wells dug in virtually every OPEC country, and they've been finding there's been a very, very high rates of discovery. They have similar discovery rates as we have in any other country. The difference, or rather the similarity in OPEC, just as with every other country, is that the size of the discoveries has just fallen off a cliff if you look back this decade compared it to the one before or the one before. It's what you would expect intuitively, that you'd find all the big stuff first, and the statistics really bear that out.
And how much of the poor discovery record is the result of constraints in oil company exploration budgets? The shareholders have demanded they return the money to them rather than spending it on drilling. How much of a factor is that?
Well, I think it's the causality is reversed. It's one of the reasons why oil companies are giving the money back is because if you go back 30 years, oil companies, and I work with a lot of people who relate this anecdote, you go back 30 years, oil companies would look at a map of the world and there'd be a lot of flags indicating explored areas, but there'd be huge tranches of the world where there were no flags. Now you look at the world and there's really nowhere to go that hasn't been very well explored. I mean, there's Antarctica and there's a couple of other places that the minute you mention them, environmentalists go through the roof. But there's just not that many other places to go look for oil. And rather than just blowing the money away, yes, they're giving it back to shareholders.
So say 10 or 20 years from now, production peaks and starts a long decline. What happens then?
Things are going to have to happen before that, because as soon as people realize that we're approaching that point, the price of oil is going to reach levels sufficient to curtail demand. I mean, that gap that I'm saying can develop between supply and demand is a logical inconsistency. It doesn't make any sense. It's just to indicate that the trends that we have in play here are simply unsustainable, and the good thing about an unsustainable trend is that it doesn't carry on forever. So something's going to have to change. It's not clear what that's going to be. I mean, you may well see the things already coming into play that the impact of oil and the possibility of a shortage of oil is really going to exacerbate. For example, China interacting with the UN to prevent sanctions against the Sudan. A main cause for that, why they did that in the UN, is because they wanted to, they have great ties with the Sudanese because they produce about 40% of their oil there. I suspect you'll be seeing more and more patterns like this. I mean, if I was Iran, for example, and I was looking for some kind of insulation from the UN Security Council, I might be very interested in doing business with China, who has a permanent seat and a veto on the UN Security Council. So it has enormous geopolitical implications, this possibility of this gap, because as long as supply meets demand, OPEC needs America to buy their oil just as America needs OPEC oil. Once you get the possibility of this gap developing, then there's a huge strategic hole for someone, and it looks like it's going to be China, stepping into here. And OPEC say, well, we don't need the U.S. to buy our oil right now. How the U.S. addresses this, it's going to have to address it. How exactly, I'm not quite sure.
Now, one of the theories of why the Bush administration decided to invade Iraq was that they want to get a piece of their oil. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's anything to that?
No, I really don't. And we actually did work for them on the Iraqi oil infrastructure and so on. And we were quite explicit that we didn't think that Iraq's oil was going to pay for the reconstruction. We didn't see how that was viable. We thought they were overly optimistic on oil production. But no, my personal impression, not speaking as a PFC energy person, just my impression is that this actually was an ideological war. You can fault the ideology, but the people that we spoke to did not, I don't think this was about oil. Do we care about the Middle East in particular because that's where the oil is? Sure. But I don't believe that this was genuinely about oil. I think there was a much bigger ideological textbook in play.
Now, do we have the long-term political and economic planning wisdom in order to manage a transition to a world in which oil supplies begin to get constrained in not all that great a period of time?
It's really not that long period of time. I mean, if you're talking about literally a decade or, you know, and if you have an extra 5 years on top of that, changes that need to be made are going to have to start to be addressed now. And I don't see anything even beginning to pass for the political will that would be necessary to address these issues. You have an unfortunate dichotomy in this country. You have Democrats when it comes to oil and energy. Democrats want to address demand issues. Republicans tend to want to address supply issues. Both of these are going to have to be addressed. I mean, and again, this is my personal opinion. When people talk about drilling in Alaska, if you're going to say we're not going to drill in Alaska, but you're not going to address demand, all that means is that someone else is going to have some of their environment ruined by drilling. It seems to me that if Americans want to drive Hummers and want to use be incredibly energy inefficient and drive massive cars that I don't really understand the need for, it should be drilled. You should drill America first before ruining the Nigerian coast, et cetera, drilling in the North Sea. If it's not drilled in Alaska, it's going to be drilled somewhere else.
Well, we also want to have it happen in somebody else's backyard, though,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Well, thank you for joining us, Seth Kleinman.
Good talking to you.
Seth Kleinman is an analyst with PFC Energy, the consultancy based in Washington, D.C. And let's take a little break, and we'll be back with some presidential politics.
I never looked around, never second guessed. Then I read some hours in, now I'm always depressed. And now I can't sleep from years of apathy, all because I read a little Noam Chomsky. I'm eating vegetation cause of fast food nation. I wear a couple shoes cause of globalization. I'm watching Michael Moore expose the awful truth. I'm listening to Public Enemy and Reagan Youth. I see no world peace cause of zealous armed forces. I eat no breath mints cause I'm from the hoof horses. Now I can't believe what an absolute failure. The president's laughing cause he voted for Nader. That's no way to go, Franco, un-American. No way to go, Franco, un-American. No way to go, Franco, un-American. Where can we go, Franco, un-American? I wanna move north and be a Canadian. Or hang down low with the nice Australians. I don't wanna be another I don't care again. What are we gonna do, Franco, Franco, un-American?
And that was the redemption portion of the song, Franco Un-American by the venerable punk band. I think they were founded about 20 years ago. No FX from California. Guy gets depressed because he's read Little Noam Chomsky. The president is laughing because we voted for Nader, he says. So, anyway, this is WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM in the dial. My name is Doug Henwood, and the show is Behind the News. And now let's turn to some presidential political issues. Tonight is the first night of the great presidential debates, which are really not going to be much of a debate. It would just be two robots talking into space, I guess, not really engaging much with each other, and hosted by the incredibly tedious Jim Lehrer of the eponymous NewsHour. It doesn't really sound like an attractive way to spend a TV viewing evening, but that's politics in America. And a couple of items to talk about in the presidential realm before we get to the interview with Glenn Ford, which I recorded and broadcast several weeks ago. First of all, is there a Republican bias at Gallup? Connoisseurs of polling, and as many listeners probably can tell, I'm one, have been stunned by the presidential preference polls of the last few months. Most stunning have been the numbers coming out of our most famous pollster, Gallup. Recall that Gallup reported a one-point decline in Kerry's popularity after the Democratic convention, a sharp departure from historical precedent since candidates usually get a 5 to 7 point bounce after their nominating conventions. By contrast, Bush got a very big bounce. The Gallup poll released right after the election put him 13 points ahead of Kerry. Other pollsters have reported a solid Bush lead in recent weeks, but Gallup has been way out in front, and they've contributed enormously to a sense that Bush is now the favorite by a large margin on November 2nd. Further, if you look below the surface at Gallup's reported party breakdown, they say 43% of their respondents identify as Republicans and 31% as Democrats, an 8% lead for the Republicans. It's a 12% lead for the Republicans, sorry. Well, we've never seen anything like a 12-point Republican lead anywhere else before. A New York Times CBS poll in July reported the breakdown as 37% Democrat and 29% Republican, an 8-point Democratic advantage. The exit polls in both the 2000 and 1996 elections reported the breakdown as 39% Democrat and 35% Republican, a 4-point Democratic advantage. Party affiliations change over time for sure, but a 16 or 20-point shift seems highly unlikely over the course of 4 years, much less 2 months. If you reweight the Gallup polls, actually, use their internal numbers and reweight them according to these different party breakdowns reported by other polling organizations, you end up not with a substantial Bush lead, but a substantial Kerry lead of 6 to 8 percentage points. So something is going on there. Gallup has also been fairly consistently reporting higher approval ratings for Bush than other pollsters over the last year or two. What's going on? Part of the problem is that in its so-called horse race polls, Gallup is using a filter to estimate so-called likely voters. They ask a series of questions about voting history, knowledge of your polling place, and intentions designed to strip out the stay-at-homes. While this is a reasonable technique in the days before an election, it may not be so sensible a month or two before when people just haven't firmed up their intentions yet. A review of the last 4 election polls by Ree Teixeira, a frequent guest in this show, shows that Gallup's estimates for all registered voters are actually more accurate than those for likely voters in 3 of those 4 cases. But is this a matter of mere technique or is something else going on? There may be some hidden partisan bias at work. In June 2003, Gallup CEO James Clifton gave $2,000 to a very right-wing Republican who was running for Senate in Georgia, Herman Cain. Journalists are not supposed to do these things. Many newspapers are even forbidding reporters to go to the Kerry benefit concerts headlined by Bruce Springsteen, since the proceeds go to the Democratic campaign. Taking this concern for appearances to an absurd extreme, former Washington Post editor Ben Bradley doesn't even bother to vote. But apparently this notion of ethics doesn't extend to the CEO of the world's most famous pollster. Since I'm a paying member of the American Association for Public Opinion Research, APOR, I subscribe to their electronic discussion list known as APORNet. When I raised some of these concerns on the list, I was met with mostly hostile responses, dismissed as baseless partisan sleaze. But the postings did inspire a call from a former Gallup researcher who was lurking on the list last week, who opened the conversation by saying they're all Republicans. Well, not all, he clarified, just most of the senior people, like editor-in-chief Frank Newport, whom I interviewed in this show a few weeks ago, and senior editor Lydia Sod. An exception is Democrat David Moore, another senior analyst. I asked Sod and Newport for comments. They haven't gotten back to me yet. I'm not saying Gallup cooks the books. I don't really believe that. But in a field where you have to make a lot of choices about techniques, your unconscious preferences can easily lead you to choices that fit your biases and to ignore doubts about your own choices. So take those Gallup polls with at least several grains of salt. And just a couple of, oh, yes, more polling data. The Program in International Policy Attitudes at the Maryland School of Public Affairs, University of Maryland, reported today, or yesterday rather, they've been doing a series of polls on asking people what their knowledge of public events are. They were the people that reported some months ago that folks who watch Fox are systematically misinformed about many, many things. Well, now they discover that people who support George Bush are deeply misinformed by many of his foreign policy positions. And by contrast, people who support Kerry are actually fairly well informed about his foreign policy positions. Majorities of Bush supporters, they report, incorrectly assume that Bush favors including labor and environmental standards in trade agreements. 84% of Bush supporters actually believe that, even though it's not true. They also believe that the U.S. supports the International Test Ban Treaty, which we don't. They also believe the U.S. Is part of the International Criminal Court. Two-thirds of them believe that, even though we don't. And the treaty banning landmines, 72% of them believe that and don't, even though it's not true. And the Kyoto Treaty on Global Warming. They're divided between those who knew that Bush favors building a new missile defense system and those who believe that he wishes, incorrectly believe he wishes to do more research until its capabilities are proven. By majorities of Kerry supporters in the 70, 80, 90% range actually can identify his foreign policy positions. Also identify his foreign policy positions correctly. And even the uncommitted people who are sure not the swing voters, those who are not sure which candidate they plan to vote for, also misread Bush's positions on most issues by a plurality, not a majority. But still, people incorrectly believe that Bush supports lots of broadly progressive things in the foreign policy arena, even though he doesn't. So Bush's lead, if such lead exists, is based on deep misperceptions of many of his positions, such as the state of political knowledge in America. And a couple of words about the economic records of the two parties while their presidents are in office. Well, can't say directly that presidents determine what goes on in the economy under during their time in office. There do seem to be some broad tendencies. Specifically, growth rates, GDP growth rates, are quite substantially stronger under Democratic regimes, going back to 1945, than under Republicans. GDP growth averaged 4.6% a year during Democratic administrations over the last 60 years or so, and 2.7% during Republican administrations. The top five spots in growth rates are all claimed by Democrats, and the bottom five by Republicans. The record of employment growth, job growth, is quite similar. Democratic average of 2.9% job growth at an average annual rate is more than twice as high as the Republican average of 1.3%. The extremes are also similarly populated, with the top five slots filled by Democrats and the bottom three by GOPers. The Bush administration is the only one with a negative sign in front of its average. And even if we just look at the last year, when growth has accelerated a little bit in the job market, it's still below long-term historical averages by a considerable margin. The stock market actually tends to do better, although the record isn't quite as lopsided as it is in the growth numbers under Democrats and it does under Republicans. But the bond market, which loves a slow economy and slack in the labor market and low inflation, that does a lot better under Republicans. And also inflation is more likely to come down under Republicans and rise under Democrats. The picture on wages is quite mixed. Real wages both rising and falling under Democrats and Republicans. No clear partisan pattern there. But job growth, economic growth, and even stock market growth, much better under Democrats than Republicans on balance. And now let's turn to an interview I recorded about a couple of months ago, I guess, for the last fundraiser, which we didn't really get to broadcast in its uninterrupted fullness, to raise money and spoke over it and cut it short. So I want to rerun that in full. Glenn Ford, who is the co-publisher of the excellent website The Black Commentator, blackcommentator.com, talking about the stakes of the presidential election. So let's listen to that. Glenn Ford, co-editor of the Black Commentator website.
Welcome to WBAI, Glenn Ford. First, let's go back, review a little ancient history, the Democratic primary, and Howard Dean, now fading from memory. But he attracted a lot of controversy for having said that the Democrats should be going after the votes of people with Confederate flags in their pickup trucks. And you wrote about that. So what was your thinking about that incident? He was widely lambasted as a racist for having said that, but what do you think?
Well, he was not initially lambasted as a racist for saying that. He made those remarks in February of 2003 at a national Democratic meeting. He was given a standing ovation in that speech. It was a rousing speech. He got the best reception of any of the candidates or wannabe candidates in the room while making those remarks. Those remarks were not called into question until November of 2003 by a combination of Al Sharpton and North Carolina Senator John Edwards. And that occurred after Sharpton had a fit when Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. endorsed Dean. Previous to that, Sharpton had not had anything negative to say about Dean's remarks. And so they were not widely considered to be racist for a full, 8-9 months until Sharpton and Edwards jumped on him.
But what do you think of the substance of the remarks?
I think the substance was absolutely fine. What he was saying was that poor white folks ought to be voting with Democrats because poor white folks in pickup trucks don't have health insurance. Their children don't go to schools that are as good as they should be, that they should be sharing the same social agenda as other Democrats, implicitly as black folks down south. And that's absolutely true. Of course, we have white false consciousness that we call manifests itself as racism. So white people in pickup trucks do not vote their interests. But that's all Dean was saying, that white people in pickup trucks ought to vote their interests, and that would mean not voting for the Republican Party. So what is wrong with that? Nothing was considered to be wrong with that until Sharpton, in his fury at Jesse Jackson and Jesse Jackson Jr. for endorsing Dean, made it seem to be some kind of racist construction. And John Edwards, of course, jumped in, hopping up and down like a little puppet, glad to have a black ally.
Speaking of Sharpton, well, what's your opinion of him?
I think that Sharpton is a profoundly disorganized person, an absolutely brilliant man who's very disorganized. And his disorganized habits of work, which are well known, they're legion, leads him into unstable situations, which periodically get him in trouble, which make him vulnerable in terms of funding, so that he winds up making alliances with Republicans, which led to, I believe, his breakup with the Jesse Jackson camp. Remember Frank Watkins, Jesse Jackson's longtime aide, became a campaign manager for Al Sharpton, but left in absolute frustration at Sharpton's habits of work and also inklings of the association with Republicans. So Sharpton gets himself in trouble and then has an outburst as if someone else has gotten him in trouble. And it makes him look unstable, but he's a brilliant man.
And let's go back to the topic of what you called white false consciousness. What is responsible for what appears to be white people, poorer white people especially, voting against their material interests?
well, we have a country that's rooted in slavery, so that you don't have people actually sharing the same class historically. You have black people who were in slavery and actually subject to the whims of the entire white population. So we haven't historically had classical class relationships in this country. White people, as a body, as poor as they might be, still have privileges that black people, as brilliant or even moneyed as they might be, don't have. Apparently, well, clearly, white people, many white people, value those privileges more than they do their class position.
Tom Frank has a book out, What's the Matter with Kansas, which argues in part that Republicans have pulled a great con trick, getting poorer whites to vote on a whole bunch of cultural issues that obscure economic issues. What do you think of that argument?
That's the story of America. That's why we don't have a labor party. That's why we have distorted political relationships in America. At the heart of the American problem is race, and that means white false consciousness, white people refusing to act in their own self-interest. This is nothing new. It is the story. It is the core story of the United States.
And now let's talk about the Kerry Bush contest, the idea that there's not much difference or not enough difference between the two to justify voting for Kerry is popular in the American left. Certainly it's at the heart of the Nader campaign. What do you think of that line of argument?
Kerry is running a classic Democratic Leadership Council campaign, and the whole idea in a DLC campaign is to get as close as possible to your opponent so that there's hardly any daylight between you and he. The theory is that if you're running against the right, you go as far to the right as you can, and theoretically, you'll claim everything to the left. However, that fails to take into consideration any of the constituencies that you want to address. In fact, the DLC wants to liquidate constituencies within the Democratic Party, and we saw that dramatically manifest at the Democratic National Convention, where no constituency was allowed to speak. The DLC focuses on a mathematical construct that they call the center, which really is nobody. And therefore, the appeal is an empty one, an appeal at a mathematical construct of voters, but no one in particular. And this is the reason that Kerry has so great a problem in getting traction. Everything says that he should be far, far ahead of Bush by now. Everything's going wrong for Bush, but things are not going right for Kerry. That's because the DLC kind of campaign does not appeal to anyone in particular.
Has this DLC strategy pushed Kerry and the party so far to the right that there's not much point in voting for them?
Well, it's a strategy. Whether Kerry really is a rightist is a different question. The DLC strategy is to go as far to the right as possible, so there is no daylight between the Kerry camp, as little daylight as possible between the Kerry campaign and the GOP. In that fashion, the theory goes, as I said, that they will pick up everything to the left of Bush, sweep it all up. That's the theory. It really doesn't work that way because you're not appealing to anyone in particular. You're just positioning.
But how have they gone so far to the right in taking their base, which and black voters are a very important part of that base, so much for granted that it's worth punishing them?
There is nothing more important than defeating Bush. Bush is a clear and present danger to the world. These Bush pirates set out to destroy world order, to shake the world up, to get rid of the United Nations, to make it irrelevant, so as to reorder the world. And they put us all, everyone on this planet, in danger in that process. There's nothing more important than getting rid of Bush. We'll have to just deal with Kerry later.
And I was about to ask you, since we were on the eve of the Republican Convention, any thoughts on the Republican Party as an institution? You sort of introduced that, but what about the party beyond Bush? Where does it come from? Who do they represent? And is it something to be alarmed about as an institution?
The Republican Party's political base is fundamentally racist. They are now based in the South. Those are the states that they count on. When they build electoral strategies, they're based upon having the old Confederacy on their side. And they can't separate themselves from that, despite their talk about diversity. And in fact, they really would like to have black appointees. They'd like to create an alternative black political leadership out of their appointments policy. But it's very difficult for them to do that because of the fundamentally racist base that they operate from out of the old Confederacy. So they are quite dangerous. They're more than just a corporate party because they do depend upon this base in the South.
And finally, a few words about your website, The Black Commentator. What's it about? How long it's been around? What do you do?
Well, we began on April 5th, 2 years ago. It's our effort to create a dialogue among blacks and progressives to answer fundamental questions. What is to be done? We hope we're doing a good job, but only our readers can tell us if that's true or not.
And that was Glenn Ford, interview recorded very late August, which I ran on the fundraiser about that time, but it was interrupted by a lot of begging, so I thought it was worth listening to in its entirety. And Glenn Ford is the co-editor of the website The Black Commentator, which is at blackcommentator.com on the web. Consistently intelligent and provocative website that I find that is not well enough known, so check it out if you haven't done so already. And I have a new piece up today on, first of all, how black voter registration breaking records, but white war schizophrenia will determine the election. And they review the evidence of really record-breaking levels of registration of black voters across the country. At the same time, the Republicans are not really succeeding in registering their people. And this is causing some alarm in Republican circles because it may also be confounding a lot of the polling projections because if there are a whole lot of new voters, they may not be in the models which the pollsters used to forecast election outcomes and also creates problems for the Gallup likely voter model I was talking about a little while ago. That if you've got a whole bunch of new people and fired up base that wants to get out there and vote against George Bush, then they may not be being taken proper account of. But, of course, the Black Commentator continues and points out that despite all these new voters, the election will be determined largely by the white vote, and the white vote will turn on Iraq. A lot of ambivalence about that, a lot of reluctance to cut and run, a lot of patriotic pride in kicking ass in Iraq, and especially among white men. Even though growing ambivalence about the adventure in Iraq is being revealed in the polls, people may not vote with that. And so what depends, what happens in Iraq, the Black Commentator argues, over the next several weeks may well determine the electoral outcome. And that's about it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. And I know it's very unprofessional to direct personal messages to the audience, but I will be very unprofessional and say that this NoFX song bears the name, the title, shares the name with my wife, Liza, and wanted to play this, dedicate this for her, to her. NoFX's Liza. Thank you.
dad would be Vanilla Bean. The blend is one to make her scream, and that's what she likes to hear the most. She's got a dad that rivals scream. She's the one who's on the prey. She used to wear her hair short long, determining her preference. She didn't like that dynamic. Trading in her flannel shirt, her 6-inch heels, latex skirt. She even bought herself some bras. Tasted 31 flavors. There's only one she really hates.